Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange. Thirty-five years ago, Steve Callahan faced a sailor's nightmare. While off the coast of Africa, his boat capsized and was destroyed, leaving him nothing but the life raft and a few tools he saved from his sinking vessel. When his boat sank, he began a struggle to stay alive in the face of hunger, thirst, sharks, waves, and the torment that comes with not knowing whether this day would be his last. Spoiler alert, he lived to tell the tale. How he survived is spelled out in his memoir, Adrift, 76 Days Lost at Sea. It's an incredible tale of survival, ingenuity, and the human spirit. And Steve Callahan joins us now to talk about this incredible experience and what came after. What questions do you have for Steve about the sea, about survival, and about strength in the face of death? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also weigh in on Facebook or on Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Steve Callahan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your life as a sailor before you set out on this journey. What was your experience like? What were you doing? And at what stage of your life were you at?
Well, I was building boats when I got out of college. Basically, at that time, there were a lot of people building their own boats to, there was a back to the land movement and a sort of back to the sea movement as well. Where people were building boats and going off voyaging. And so I was running around helping people build boats for a while and ended up in Maine because my wife wanted to do some organic farming, and that was a good place to do it at the time, and we could afford land. And but that relationship kind of went south. I decided to fulfill a lot of childhood dreams, which were inspired by a number of people when I was quite young. Thor Heyerdahl, who went across the Pacific in a balsa wood raft named Contiki, and especially another gentleman who had bought a 13.5-foot little wooden boat to sail around the pond, essentially put a deck on it and sailed it to England, called Tinkerbell. And that man's name was Robert Manry. Mm-hmm. And that was a great inspiration to me because it showed me that, you know, you could kind of have a life of adventure. You didn't have to be really wealthy or have particular talents, which suited me. And I was just obsessed with boats from the time I was like 12 or so. And boats is kind of the tool to get out there. Really, what I really loved were wilderness environments, either the mountains or the ocean. And so after getting out of school, that's what I focused on. And I had been building boats for a while, and then after moving to Maine, was transitioning into designing and teaching design at a design school near us. And so I built Napoleon Solo, 21 feet, about the size of your average van, I guess you could say. Not a lot of room in it, but I was very interested in efficient lifestyles and what you could do with fairly rudimentary equipment. So I set off from America to cross the Atlantic, which I did in 1981. And to get home then, after being broke, I decided I better get back to someplace where I could make some money again. I left England, sailed down Spain, Portugal, out to Madeira, down to the Canary Islands, which are just off the Sahara coast and stretch out quite a ways into the Atlantic, and mm-hmm. left there for about a week. A week, had wonderful sailing until all hell broke loose.
Right. Yeah. No, this was not Napoleon Solo's maiden voyage across the Atlantic. You made one voyage first, and you were on your way back.
Yeah, I had already crossed the Atlantic. We had launched the boat in 1980 in Annapolis, Maryland, and sailed it back to Massachusetts through some nice fall gale. So we had a good shakedown there, and then went all the way across the Atlantic. I'd been on the boat for almost a year by the time I lost it.
Yeah, and before you went out on this journey in the first place, tell us about what your family was saying to you about it.
Oh, you mean about me being completely stark raving mad?
They kind of
knew that. I don't know. My mother never really quite understood. I was a philosophy major in university, and she used to say things like, "Don't you wish you'd studied something more specific?" I don't know. I don't think any of them really quite got it. I think my father did to a certain degree. You know, he was kind of an outdoorsy kind of guy. Loved the ocean himself. But they came from coal mining country in Virginia. Most of my extended family worked in the coal mines and whatnot. So they didn't have a lot of experience at sea or any of that thing. But they did love the outdoors. So they kind of got that part of it.
Mm-hmm. And you write in this book about the sea being in some ways representative of the idea of simplicity, living simply. What is it about the sea that enables you to live simply?
Well, I think, and whenever you venture into any wilderness environment, you know, before I was sailing, or even especially in the early years when I started sailing, I was also climbing the mountains of New Hampshire and Vermont and the Rockies and whatnot. And I got this very similar feelings in these places where we surround ourselves with so many things these days. But when you're in living out of a backpack or in a very small boat, especially, you have what you need and you don't really have a lot more than that. And you're always dealing with problems that crop up with really limited resources. And it's interesting to try to solve problems with limited resources in an isolated environment. At least I always found it interesting. It's just a direct life. When we live as I do now, surrounded by society, society is complicated, and people have we're complex. We have agendas and things. Whereas nature doesn't really have that. Nature's just what it is. So it's easier to figure out in a lot of ways. And I guess I'm a pretty simple guy at base.
And certainly we'll get into some of the ideas of living simply, the freedom of the sea. If you have questions for Steve, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also weigh in on Twitter @NHPRExchange. So you're sailing off the coast of Africa on your way back, having made the journey once across the Atlantic in Napoleon Solo. And then things went very bad very quickly. Tell us about that moment where you knew something awful had happened and you're going to have to be immediate and respond immediately to nature.
Yeah, well, the weather had been getting a little bit bad, but I wasn't very worried about it because I'd seen a lot worse weather. So we were kind of reaching or going sideways to the wind and the waves across, I don't know, the waves were probably a few meters high, which may sound huge, but then that's not that big in terms of the ocean. And everything seemed in control. And I kept getting up and kind of checking the boat, making sure everything was all right, and making pretty good speed. But
what's pretty good speed?
Oh, like 5 knots or something. Not super fast, but not slow either. A lot of times you want to have the boat moving at kind of the right speed. If it's too slow, then you're totally at the mercy of the elements and you have no control. It's just beating you up. If it's too fast, then you're driving the boat too hard. So it's like a speed management thing. But it was fine. And then I stupidly took off all my clothes to lie down and go to sleep for a while, which I do for an hour at a time, and was just kind of half awake, half asleep when there was a huge bash in the side of the boat. It lurched and water just came spewing in, and I mean like a river of water. And so it was immediately apparent to me that the boat was doomed. I had watertight compartments in the boat, and but they weren't really designed to keep it afloat if the main compartment was so badly damaged. So I thought it was going to go straight to the bottom, but it was pretty fortunate that the way the boat nosed down, it filled with water. I don't know. It's hard to know time when these things occur, because time gets compressed and does funny things. But it seemed like within a minute, the boat was basically flooded with water. And the nose of the boat was completely underwater, and the tail end of it was just up a little bit. But that meant every wave that was that came across the boat would sweep across the entire thing. So I got up and did what I was kind of trained to do and had gone through my mind to do many, many times. I was pretty well prepared. I had a bag of gear all prepared. I had a six-person offshore life raft on the deck and whatnot. And so I was fortunate that the boat kind of didn't go straight to the bottom, but kind of stabilized there. And so I made trips back and got the life raft inflated and all that and got gear in and then tried to wait it out. But I got broken away from the boat just before dawn. And so I knew there I am in the middle, basically in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, drifting downwind and down current would take me months to get to land, and it was a pretty dismal awakening.
The number to call is 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org, and we've got a call now from Steve in Auburn. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm a licensed captain myself, done quite a bit of long-range deliveries. I was going out to Georges when I was 8 years old, and basically kind of live the life a little bit of this gentleman. And I'm just wondering, you know, Steve, is it your opinion that, you know, you keep on going out to sea like this, keep on doing a lot of long range stuff? It's just a matter of time before the raft is reality to you?
Yes and no. I think I was quite aware from the beginning that when you go offshore, you obviously embrace the risks of going offshore. And like any other isolated environment, there isn't necessarily somebody who's going to pull you out of the problem you've gotten yourself into. So I went with a pretty independent attitude, especially in that area. You got to remember, this is 1982. It's before a lot of, you know, some people had single sideband radio and things like that, but we didn't have the global communications we have now. I had an EPIRB or emergency beacon that sends out kind of an SOS signal, if you will. But at the time, it wasn't monitored by satellites the way they are now or anything like that. So I knew it was a possibility, and I had known other people who had been on the edge at sea before. So I think that if you constantly are in wilderness environments, things happen. I have, in my sailing career, lost a mast in mid-ocean. I've lost rudders. I've saved another boat from sinking. I've had a fire aboard. You know, stuff happens, and you realize what all those risks are. But it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be in a life raft. I know people who have sailed, you know, three, four times as much as I have, who have sailed literally, you know, 500,000 miles, and they've had problems and they've dealt with problems, but they've never had to get into a life raft.
Mm-hmm. And to go back to that moment where everything went really badly for you, we're still not 100% sure what it was, but you think it might be a whale that hit you?
Yeah, that's a high probability, let's say. It could have been also a large shark. I've hit in a 1986 transatlantic race. I hit a basking shark, which are like 25 feet and very big animals, that stopped a 60-foot boat going pretty full speed. Just bang, I thought we lost the mast at first. So it could have been another large animal. There are plenty out there. But I've been around whales a lot at sea. I hit a sperm whale in 1979 doing a delivery to Bermuda, broad daylight, but very choppy seas, and couldn't see it until we were right on top of it. And for the owner of that boat, it was the second whale he had hit that summer going to Bermuda. You know, in a sailboat, it doesn't make a lot of noise relative to a ship or a motorboat. And you're, especially if they're breaking waves around, and, you know, whales are swimming along, minding their own business, and, you know, you just have random collisions. You think with the ocean, it would be really hard to hit something out there. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had to change course to avoid a collision with a ship or, you know, those sorts of things. Wow. So I just think it was just a random collision. But I've also seen containers afloat, pieces of boat, trees. There's a lot of stuff to hit out there. But yeah. I just didn't make those explanations didn't make much sense to me.
The whale is the only explanation that could possibly make sense.
Yeah.
For whatever hit you or whatever you ran into, it forced you onto this relatively small life raft with just you had planned a bag of gear and just for this reason, right?
Right.
Just in case you actually had to stay on a raft for any length of time.
Yes.
So tell us about a little bit about what you brought on the raft with you.
Okay. Well, the raft had been actually prepared by somebody else. It wasn't. It wasn't a brand new raft. It was it had all been inspected, and it actually was better prepared than your average raft. It had extra equipment in it, including some solar stills.
Solar stills being the things that could distill salt water into fresh water.
Yes, exactly, or at least theoretically.
Yes, in theory.
Oh, things like sponges, a couple little paddles, you know, stuff like that. Not, there wasn't that. There's not that much in life rafts. There were a few flares. I don't know, but mostly I depended on the gear that was in my ditch kit or equipment bag that I had put together myself, and that included. Knives and string and hooks and a couple of very critical things included another solar still and a spear gun that would provide me with virtually all of my food and paper and pencils, which were really important to me, these little dime store pads of paper and pencils, a chart, etc.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't have anything to sort of capture the wind and sail, so you basically had to go where the current was taking you.
Yeah, the raft is, it's like a couple of inner tubes, one stacked on top of the other. The floor is about a 16th-inch thick reinforced rubber, so you feel every little bubble or everything that comes across the bottom of the raft. And on the top is a tent, essentially. So I could position the tent. I dragged a line out the back of the raft with a pole on it that I figured would increase my visibility in case the raft was down in a trough, the pole would be up and so on. And that gave me some directional control of the raft rather than it just kind of spinning around. And I could position the canopy, the tent, across the wind to increase my drag and increase my speed a little bit. But it, on a good day with about a half knot of current and maybe a half knot of speed through the water, I'd make 24, 25 miles a day, something like that.
Which made you think in the early days of you being out in the raft that you would end up where exactly?
Well, I figured I would eventually drift to the Caribbean islands, hopefully. I was very worried about drifting a little bit north because as you get closer to the Caribbean, the current and the dominant winds swing a little bit more southerly. So I could have missed the islands and get swept up into the Gulf Stream. Next stop would have been England again. And there's no way I could have done that. So I tried to position the angle, the canopy, and try to force myself as far south as I could, and it ended up fortunately being able to hit the islands.
It's an incredible journey, and we're going to talk more about it in just a little bit. We're speaking with Steve Callahan. He's the author of Adrift, 76 Days Lost at Sea. He also consults on boat design and construction and teaches seamanship and survival skills. He assists in movies involving the sea as well. He was a consultant on Life of Pi. Steve will also be on hand for a presentation, discussion, and Q&A session tonight at 7 at Red River Theaters in Concord as part of the Concord Reads program. What questions do you have for Steve about survival in general? Comes in a variety of forms, of course. You may have survived your own battle with what seemed to be imminent death. Tell us about that story, or just ask Steve about a question about survival on the seas or in general. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can weigh in on this discussion on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
It's not a reaction that you can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah. This week on Something Wild, prepare for the heebie-jeebies.
Garter snakes are more cold tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. Winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
Chris Martin has the 411 on our slithering neighbors. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild, wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, cool stuff.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are talking this hour with Steve Callahan. He's the author of Adrift, a memoir of his 76 days lost at sea. He also consults on boat design and construction and teaches seamanship and survival skills. The number to call to ask Steve a question is 1-800-892-6477. Call with your questions for Steve about his experience on the water and his life after this tremendous ordeal. You can also email us. The exchange, the address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or tweet us at NHPR Exchange. And Steve's here in the studio with us now. We're going to jump into some of your questions. Let's go to Jay in Concord. Jay, what's your question or comment?
Hi, good morning. I just finished your book, and it was outstanding. I am a Maine Maritime Academy graduate, so it was very, very near and dear to me on what you experienced. My question is, you know, one of the things I think that saved you was the duplicity of having the water scope. I'm just wondering if you have seen advancements in the equipment that's now put into lifeboats that maybe was an outcome of your experience.
Okay, a little bit shaky on the line there, but he's asking about advancements in equipment.
Right.
And yeah, what about that? I mean, this was 35 years ago. Certainly technology has changed. What about now? What technology is available now?
Some really dramatic improvements that were made even very shortly after I landed, unfortunately for me. people would often ask me, you know, well, what do you recommend to take and so on that you didn't have? One thing that I didn't have was a handheld VHF radio. Even in the 80s, shortly after I got back, you know, people were starting to carry these little handheld radios and they had waterproof pouches. Now you can get them waterproof in themselves. And I figure probably at least one of the ships that passed me by, I mean, 9 ships passed me by the end, and I had a whole arsenal of flares. I figured maybe one of the early ships would have at least listened to the radio. My experience at sea is at least half the time you get a response from a ship if you radio them. So that would have been a big help. The other thing is that the EPIRB that I mentioned, the Emergency Position Indicating Radio Beacon, which is a whole mouthful, began being monitored by satellite. And they're very good today, although I do have to add the caveat that over 90% of signals from EPIRBs are false alarms, and there are lots of parts of the world where you can be lost, and people can know that you're lost, but there are no search and rescue facilities anywhere near you, and even if they divert a ship, it could be days and days away. So you can never count on that. And another thing that is a big improvement is water maker. Today we have reverse osmosis water makers. You can get quite small ones, weigh about 3 pounds, and you can pump fresh water from seawater. Now these have evolved from very large commercial units, but they use this energy recovery system so that you can actually hand pump fresh water from salt water. It's not a lot, but it's way better than I had. It took me all day to produce about a pint of water, and it was grueling. And as far as I know, I'm the only person to have gotten at least this style of solar stills to work at all in the real world.
That's incredible. I can't imagine what you felt when you learned that there was a pump that could just pump fresh water out of seawater.
Yeah, well, that took about another decade, I think, or so to come out. But it's a lot better for people. Rafts themselves haven't changed a lot. They changed after 1978. There was a infamous Fastnet disaster race off of England where a lot of sailors got killed, and they did, as a result of that, they did a lot of testing on rafts. They've improved stability systems a bit, and the closure system that I complained about because it just was Velcro, which is a great material but not really sufficient for a closure and a life raft. So now they're zippered up pretty much. But the quality of rafts is still quite varied. Some are quite good and some are quite bad, frankly.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a little bit more about equipment in just a moment, but I want to get to Darton and Beau. Darton, what is your question or comment for Steve Callahan?
Hey, Steve. Read your book when it first came out. Absolutely amazing story, and thank you for sharing that with everybody. I wondered, and it became, you know, my lifelong obsession with survival stories, and I just wondered whether you kind of track and read some of these that have come down the pike, and, you know, the famous, like, Heart of the Sea or the latest one a few years ago with 438 Days at Sea. Do you read any of that, or is that just bad memory for you?
No, I usually read all of it, actually, as it happens. Before I went adrift, of course, I had read the Baileys' 119 Days Adrift. They were in the Pacific, a couple. They had a conventional raft very much like mine, a little bit. I think theirs was a four-person, but same model, Avon. And they had a dinghy, an inflated dinghy. And then the Robertsons, Dougal Robertson, spent 38 days with his whole family adrift, wrote a fantastic book, Survive the Savage Seas. And that was great. That was hugely inspirational to me when I was in the raft. And I also carried a survival manual that Dougal Robertson wrote. And these days, as a matter of fact, John Franklin, who wrote 438 Days, called me up, and we spent a number of hours on the phone talking about Jose Alvarenga's experience. I often get called by media to ask about, do you think this could have possibly happened or not, and that sort of thing. So, I try to keep up with what's going on. Unfortunately, not everybody does come back, even today with all of our improvements.
Darton, quick question for you. What is it about the survival story as a genre that really intrigues you?
I don't know, and I've wondered that because I've gone, you know, through the sea survival stories, then moved into mountaineering, then into the Antarctic, you know, the endurance. I think it's just striking a chord with, you know, man's nature and ability and desire and to survive.
Well, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. Steve, there you were in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on a rubber raft. You're spearing fish and you're eating them raw. You're evaporating seawater with this sort of MacGyvered still, right? Evaporating right. Slowly. You get very little water per day. And you write about this at one point, that this deprivation was, I'm quoting here, a strange sort of gift.
Mm-hmm.
Why? How is that a gift?
Well, I think this is a very common feeling amongst survivors that I've met. And I've met dozens of all types of survivors through the years and gone to all kinds of conferences and whatnot. And it's kind of a basic theme, I think, that when you're going through really difficult times, you're able to prioritize your life in a way that is difficult in normal life. We get so distracted by other things, and so you really learn what's important. You learn the difference between need and want, and you can focus in a strange kind of clarity. And there's also something that actually is kind of an extension of sailing, which is one reason why I think I was always drawn to wilderness environments and sailing in particular. And I've talked to, you know, people who do mountain climbing and in other kinds of extreme sports. And they often talk about the same thing, which is like being in the zone. You know, we talk about being in the zone. And because you're very present. You have this kind of clarity of presence of mind that you might not get in everyday life when our minds are distracted and we're thinking about a million different things and stuff. Instead, you're wholly there. You're not really thinking about the past. You're not thinking about the future. So it's kind of like a Zen-like experience. And survival is that on steroids, I guess, really. So it's, in the end, it's kind of a spiritual experience. You know, my wife says that the key for her in Adrift is a line that also comes from a log, just like that quote came from these little papers that I kept notes on. And it was after a just a spectacular evening, at sea, and I wrote, you know, this is a view of heaven from a seat in hell, that, you know, you have this juxtaposition of terror and fear and enlightenment all kind of at the same time. So it's very intense. It's a kind of intense experience that we don't normally get in everyday life, and survivors value that. I remember I did a show, Joan Rivers, you remember the Joan Rivers show. I did the Joan Rivers show with these guys who had been with a sports team that crashed into the Andes, led to the book Alive and the movie and so on. And so I was talking to one of them in the green room off stage, and he said, you know, sometimes I just wish I was back in the mountains again. There was a purity to the experience and a clarity of his life that he felt that he could get from that, which was an absolutely horrendous experience. He ended up having to cannibalize the bodies of the dead to stay alive and so on. I mean, much in many ways, much worse than what I went through. And yet he valued that. And the Baileys, the same thing. Right before they were picked up in their life raft, he was saying, you know, he had these mixed feelings about being rescued after 119 days at sea, because he felt like he was the king of his world. You've created this whole new environment for yourself. And the survival experience doesn't end when you when your feet hit the shore either. It's actually keeps going. There's the whole post-trauma thing and everything, and you have to continue to readjust your life, which is another big challenge.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you now, is there ever a moment now where you wish you were back on that raft, just like that gentleman you spoke to?
Yeah, and I don't think I wish I was on the raft per se, but there are things that I realized even at the time that I would hugely value if I was lucky enough to get out of that situation, that in many ways the experience, you know, was hell for me. But on the other hand, it gave me visions into myself and into the world and into value of things that I couldn't have ever gained in any other way. And that's, you know, a lot of Adrift, actually, if there are kind of key themes that run through Adrift, that's one of them, that, you know, we're surrounded by paradox all the time. And that I view life as kind of having a yin-yang balance, that every time there was something horrible, there was also a bright side to it. And every time there was a bright side, there could also be a dark side. And it had more to do with what do you focus on more than what is the reality.
Exactly. Yeah. We're talking with Steve Callahan. He's the author of Adrift, which chronicles his 76 days lost at sea with only a few tools he used wisely to keep himself alive. We're also talking about survival in general, which comes in a variety of forms, of course. What hardship did you survive? Tell us your story or send us a question for Steve. Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Gretel from Brownsville, Vermont. Hi, Gretel. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I love this story. I'm so envious of this experience. And I'm wondering if this is an experience that you're grateful for. Somehow did it make your life more profound, or if you could go back, you would rather not do it again? That's it.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I am grateful for having the experience. I was very fortunate for not only to survive, but to have been, tested in many ways. You know, I came away more confident than I was before. I learned that I was much stronger and more resilient than I ever imagined I could be, because I certainly didn't think so at the beginning of this voyage. And I also learned a lot about my weaknesses, especially in the early part of the voyage. You know, once I was in the raft and I had no idea how can I possibly survive out here, then I beat myself up pretty badly, which is quite common with survivors in that stage. You know, you regret everything you did wrong in your life, and there was a very long list for me. But it also gave me a bit of a purpose to get back and kind of reorganize my life and reprioritize and know what was really important, especially regarding relationships with people and those sorts of things. So You know, in those ways, it was a very important growing possibility or opportunity for me. And not only that, but now I can't possibly separate it from the rest of my life. It's taken me down so many different roads I would never have been down. I wouldn't be sitting here today if it hadn't been for that. I've met incredibly interesting people all around the world. I've gotten to work on a couple of feature films, which was a great kick for me. So basically, no, I don't regret it at all. I wouldn't want to be back there, but it really has given me a huge gift.
Steve, we have a question from Ray on Facebook who asks, when in the raft did you feel more fearful or hopeful, and how did that fearful, hopeful balance shift over time?
The way I describe life in general in these situations is it's almost like you're suspended over the Grand Canyon sitting on a knife edge. And as uncomfortable as it is, you know, if you kind of wiggle one way or the other, you're going to plummet and that's going to be the end. So none of it is good. You have tension through the entire experience. But layered on top of that, you have highs and lows, the same as everyday life, except that the highs are unbelievably high and the lows are unbelievably low. And they can be crammed right up against one another, where, you know, all of a sudden you're, you know, the sun's out and look, I'm getting good water production and stuff. And oh my God, I just put a hole in the bottom of the raft, and you just feel like you're totally doomed. Or the opposite of that, which is you think you're on the edge of death, and you finally dawns on Marblehead that you have a solution to the problem, and you solve the problem, and then you think you're king of the world. So it's a very volatile experience. It is really not. You can't draw a line between survival and normal life. We all survive every day. We survive, you know, paying the credit card bills and surviving at work or surviving, you know, exams at school or whatever. And there's, you know, maybe there's a quantitative difference, but there's not really that big qualitative difference to me.
There were moments while you were out there where you just didn't know if you wanted to continue doing this. And I mean, you didn't consider suicide seriously. But there were moments where you wondered if you had what it took. And I'm wondering, do you think that having what it takes to survive, or at least having enough will to survive, is an innate human quality or something that you were simply lucky enough to have?
I have a mixed feeling about that. You know, a lot of survival books, survival manuals often talk about the will to survive, that is the most important thing, the will to survive. And I wouldn't disagree with that exactly, but I'm not so sure as you can't improve your will to survive, that we know for a fact that if people go through survival training, that they fare better in survival scenarios than if they haven't gone through the training. I was pretty well prepared psychologically, I think, to go through it. But another very, very almost universal, if not universal, feeling of survivors is early on in their experiences, none of us think we're going to make it. It just is too much for us to deal with and process. But there are techniques that you can develop and use, which are reflected in all these other survival books that are out, whether it's Touching the Void or 438 Days or Adrift, that where you see these commonalities. For example, when the guy falls into the crevasse and he's all busted up in the bottom of the crevasse,
right,
and he has to get down, you know, he thinks his buddies might even be gone when he gets down the mountain, you know, but he needs to move, and he knows nobody else is going to come for him. So what does he focus on? He focuses on getting to the next rock. That's it. So divvying it up to achievable little chunks.
We'll talk more about the will to survive and what it takes with Steve Callahan, the author of Adrift, 76 Days Lost at Sea, in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
It's not a reaction that can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah. This week on Something Wild, prepare for the heebie-jeebies.
Garter snakes are more cold tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. Winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
Chris Martin has the 411 on our slithering neighbors. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild, wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, cool stuff.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking with Steve Callahan. He's the author of Adrift, a memoir of his 76 days lost at sea. He's also a consultant on boat design and construction, and he teaches seamanship and survival skills. The number to call to join the conversation is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Call us with your questions for Steve about his experience on the water and his life after this tremendous ordeal. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or tweet us at @NHPRExchange. We've got a call. Oh, we did have a call. We lost the call, but we do have a question here from Facebook. Gail on Facebook said, "One of the things I love about Adrift was your description of the fish that accompanied you. Could you say a little bit about your interaction and your sense of these fish?"
Yeah, actually, if there are heroes in Adrift, it's the fish. I guess they're symbolic, really, of the grandeur, the magic, and the mystery of the sea and basically the natural world to me. And so from my point of view, anyway, I was kind of the idiot, clumsy human observer in the middle of this amazing world that was generous enough to grant me life. The fish, the Dorado, started forming around the raft right away. You know, basically anything that floats in the ocean becomes an island and develops an ecology all of its own. It can be a light bulb or a little piece of foam, and it grows barnacles and weed, and fish start to collect around it and whatnot. So Rubber Ducky, my life raft, was a relatively large island of debris, and fish started collecting around it. By the end of the voyage, there'd probably be 50 or more Dorado. These are also known as mahi-mahi. They're pretty big fish, very fast, very smart. And I got to know them individually by behavior patterns, colors, scars, all kinds of things. And they kind of were my friends, but I also had to eat them. So they were, they nourished me, kept me alive. At one point, they almost killed me. They were also a huge threat to me just because they were big and powerful, and I'm fishing for them with a spear and an inflated raft in the middle of the Atlantic. And in the end, they actually brought my salvation because of this ecosystem that developed, and that drew birds to the raft. And as I got close to the islands, those that brought fishermen out. So the Dorado really, in terms of storyline, provided a good beginning, middle, and an end. And they really symbolize, I don't know, all of life to me, a kind of a wholeness of life. And again, getting back to, you know, the sort of paradox and yin-yang balances. They were both, you know, incredibly powerful, positive forces, and also a threat to me at the same time.
Mm. Steve, were you a religious person before you left on this journey, and were you afterwards?
Well, as I said, you know, I was a philosophy student in university, and I had gone to church as a youth, but I don't practice any specific religion. I guess I have my own faith, if you will. I think I was quite a spiritual person, and I think maybe that, I don't know whether that's overused or not as a term, but I felt very connected to the world. And this is something else that's a common gain by survivors, is that, you know, our own importance kind of dwindles in a way, or at least it can. And in what keeps us going is a feeling of connection to something much greater than ourselves. In my case, the natural world, the universe. And I feel a spiritual power from that, for sure.
So over the course of your 76 days, you were spearing and eating the mahi-mahi, the Dorado. some other fish too, the flying fish. They at one point, I think one just flew right into your boat, and you just captured it before it could get up and fly away. Was that?
Well, yeah. On occasion they would crash into the boat, and I'd grab them off the canopy if I could before they flopped back in the water. And a couple of times they just came flying in. You know, I had this opening on the tent, if you will, to have access to the outside, and most of the time I would leave that open unless conditions were really horrendous. And so they would fly in on occasion. So that was a nice little added treat. The flying fish are quite delicious. And I also caught trigger fish, which were not very delicious. And I would collect gooseneck barnacles, actually growing gooseneck barnacles on this piece of line, which I would eat as these little nubs of barnacle, picking through seaweed for little crabs and shrimp and things, whatever I could find, and caught a few birds towards the end of the voyage as well.
We've got another question about conditions on the raft. Steve from Nottingham has a question for you. Steve from Nottingham, welcome to the program. What's your question or comment?
Good morning, and thank you for sharing this story. I'm a psychiatrist, and many people, when they're in these sensory deprivation or monotonous environments such as the ocean, have these kind of experiences, which is often called hallucinations and illusions. Did you have any of those type of experiences?
I have to say I don't feel like I did have them. And in fact, I kind of expected to hallucinate at times or something like that. But I felt surprisingly clear-headed. And, you know, we also know that yogis and seers of various sorts often fast in order to, I don't know, gain some kind of clarity. Maybe they're hallucinating. I don't know. But in my case, I kept a log and tried to normalize life as much as possible. And at the end of the voyage, I hadn't lost days or anything. I wasn't so sure a few times. There was one particular 10-day stretch of the voyage where I had hold the bottom of the raft, and it was a pretty grueling exercise to stay alive and fix the raft so I could continue the voyage. And that was the closest I gave to actually giving up. And I certainly was not thinking clearly, but I don't feel like I ever saw something that wasn't there or anything like that.
Certainly a variety of other survival stories out there. Jesse on Twitter asks, what did you think of the All Is Lost Redford film? Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, I am familiar with that. I don't know. I guess I have to admit it's not my favorite movie. you know, I'm a sailor, and sailors get to be pretty picky about these things. And there were, you know, like a huge, immense number of things that were not done the way sailors actually do them. In fact, quite the opposite. And I know a lot of people who've, you know, actually done this single-handed sailing around the world and whatnot. I've done a bit of single-handed sailing myself, and Robert Redford looked like a cowboy at sea to me, not really a seaman. Having said that, a lot of people somehow resonated with the film, so who am I to criticize it, really? You know, as long as you get something out of an art form, I'm all for it.
Sure. We've got another question about movies from Tim in Kittery. Tim, what's on your mind? Tim, are you there?
I guess this is kind of a follow-up to that previous one. Was All Is Lost, I've been a sailor all my life, and All Is Lost was just abysmal, all the mistakes, all the decisions a sailor wouldn't make. And you've worked as a consultant on movies, Steve. What have been kind of the challenges? You're trying to show these people how it is done, and then they don't do it the right way.
Yeah. Oh, it's a very interesting question, and I could yammer on for hours on it. I've worked on two feature films. I've been involved with some documentaries and whatnot, but the two feature films were Life of Pi and In the Heart of the Sea. In the Heart of the Sea was based on a true story, directed by Ron Howard. And Life of Pi is a very fictitious kind of wacko, fantastic allegory.
Right, like a guy's on a boat trapped with a tiger, right?
Yeah, yeah. But when Ang Lee, you know, I remember I met Ang Lee before he even took on the film, and we had long discussions about, you know, the sea and whatnot. And when I got off the plane in Taiwan where we were doing principal filming, I asked him, you know, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, I want you to make the movie better. And I just said, what does that mean? And he said, well, I want you to lend it authenticity and make it convincing, which is a tall order for that kind of a tale. But in many ways, I feel like Life of Pi is actually more authentic and realistic than All Is Lost. We paid a lot of attention to trying to make things as realistic as possible, but of course there are compromises. And when you're actually making films, a lot has to do with money and focus, and you're dealing with a lot of A-type personalities who have their own priorities. This producer said, you know, well, the movie business, he had a bunch of rules in movie business, and one of them which sticks with me is it's always the movie according to me, which means that, you know, if you're the makeup person, you don't care what else is going on, just don't mess up my makeup. And in my case, my role was to always lobby for realism. But that has to be compromised with, you know, where cameras can be and wave generators and lighting concerns and all these other things. So it's always a compromise. But I think that I was very pleased with Life of Pi because it wasn't a realistic film, but it was expressionistic. And even in Adrift, I did drawings. I don't pretend that they're realistic. They're expressionistic. There's no book that can be real, even if it's a nonfiction book. So it was fun working on the films, and it's fun lobbying for reality, but you're never going to get your whole way.
Let's talk a little bit about your rescue and then the aftermath. Certainly a significant time. So you were rescued. You were discovered by some sailors who saw the birds hovering around your boat.
Right.
They took you in, and from there the survival experience doesn't stop. It just changes somewhat. A few questions for you after that. So how long did it take you to sort of physically recover from this ordeal?
Ooh, it took about 6 months really for me to recover. Quite common with ocean survivors who've been adrift for 2-3 weeks, a month, is to lose about a third of your weight, which is what I did. You lose a lot of weight right away, thins out over time. I had hundreds of saltwater sores, which are these little open ulcers on your skin. But otherwise, I was in pretty good condition. Once I got ashore, I had very high sodium levels in my body, low potassium, so I was retaining lots of fluid. I was gaining like a kilo a day, almost all in fluid, so my legs all blew up like I had elephantiasis, and it took about, 6 weeks before I could walk any distance comfortably. Couldn't wear shoes or anything like that. But it took about 6 months for me to rebuild muscle tissue and all that sort of thing. But I was pretty fortunate.
Did it change your appetite for fish?
Not really. Yeah, it's a common question, but you know, I have to appreciate fish for what they are. I'm very conscious of the fact that we have so many people on the planet now that all of our natural resources are highly stressed, and in the years since, of course, we know that, you know, like, you know, huge parts of the population, especially of large pelagic fish like swordfish and things like that, have been totally decimated. And whether they can recover or not is an open question, really. We have to do something different going forward. But I love fish. I love them for what they are and what they've provided all of us, really.
Mm-hmm. Mia on Twitter asks, how did the very next boating jaunt feel after those 76 days?
The very next the next boating jaunt was about, I think, 10 days or something after I landed. People had heard about me through the coconut grapevine. You know, people VHF radio one another and say, hey, there's this idiot who just washed up ashore up in Marie Galante. You hear about that? And so people would stop by the island, other cruisers, and to visit and bring me banana bread and various things, which was very, very kind of them. And a boat stopped in that was owned by a guy who I knew lived in England, and it was being used as a movie boat. And there was a photographer on board I also knew. And so they gave me the chance to kind of start hitchhiking on boats my way up through the islands. And the reason why I was so anxious to do that was, first of all, I'm not that bright. And secondly, people were really kind to me when I landed, and they kind of adopted me. But it was like I totally lost control of my life. I had, you know, it was like I was a baby, and everybody was treating me like a baby. And I'd been a pretty independent guy for a long time by that stage. So I really needed to kind of get back on the horse. But I didn't really do so until the next year when I did a single-handed race to Bermuda. That was really getting back on the boat again. And but, you know, it's like I was saying before, we go through these things, but we don't stop what we're doing. You know, I've known mountain climbers who've lost their legs through falls, and they still mountain climb. It's our love, it's our passion, it's where we feel ourselves, most ourselves. So as much as I hated the experience, I don't hate the sea or fear the sea or anything like that.
So big question for you here, Steve. I mean, we all know we're going to die at some point. We don't like to think about that, of course, but sometimes we have to, especially if we're sick or in unusual circumstances like the one you went through. Sometimes we know in advance when our deaths are imminent, whether it's cancer. I mean, you've battled cancer yourself. Is there anything we could do now to sort of mentally prepare for a moment when we know our deaths are imminent?
Oh, man, that's a difficult question. And I'm not sure as I have the answer to that. I mean, it's something we all struggle with. You know, after a drift, I think I made a goal for myself. You know, survival's not, there's nothing noble about survival, frankly.
Really?
I don't feel like there is. It's just what we do because we're, you know, in my case, I had an unfinished life. My life was a mess. I needed to kind of, I don't know, give it meaning, if you will. So the goal for me when I came ashore was to be able to meet death with a certain amount of equanimity and grace. That to me is kind of a lifelong goal. It's something that we constantly work at. And you can't put yourself there until you are there. I have no idea what's going to happen when I'm taking my final breath. So I might be totally freaked out. On the other hand, I might be at total peace. I think if there's anything we can work at, it is to try to capture meaning in our life. There's a fantastic book. One of my favorite books is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who is a concentration camp survivor. And I think everybody should read that book because it really shows that no matter where you are, no matter what your situation, you can find meaning in your life. And in the end, that will allow you to face the end with grace.
Well, Steve Callahan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks for everybody for listening.
Yes, thank you, listeners. Steve Callahan is the author of Adrift, 76 Days Lost at Sea, and he also assists in movies involving the sea, including Life of Pi. Steve will be on hand for a presentation, discussion, and Q&A session tonight at 7 at Red River Theaters in Concord as part of the Concord Reads program. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The program was engineered by Emily Quirk and Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.